good. So the reason I wanted to make sure we start early, not that, you know, 30 seconds or a minute matter too much, but it just seems like there's a lot to talk about today. Of course, I usually have that feeling, but somehow it especially strikes me today. Let me start with a couple of practical things, or really one practical point, and that is just to remind you that the next session, we take about a month off now, a little more than a month. The next session doesn't start until July 17th. And that session, when we finish that session, that'll be the end of the first year of this two-year program. So in the next session, we're going to be dealing with knowledge. We've been working with space and now with time. And in a very rough way, the sense is that we're going from an exploration of first-level knowledge, which we did for the first three sessions, I guess, to now second level. But I wouldn't insist on that. I do think it's interesting to look in terms of these different levels. And I think what we're exploring now is going deeper. Maybe that's just a simple way to say it, going deeper. I'm just worried, I guess, that when we're done with these, then we're supposed to go on to the third level. That always makes me nervous. So anyway, we are looking at what you could think of as the second level of time today, and we're finishing it up. And then we'll move on to knowledge next time after a fairly substantial break. Now, some of you are going to be on the retreat, so you don't get you don't get the same substantial break, but you get the retreat, which should be really exciting because we're, you know, it's a chance for us to come together after almost a year of working with this material. So it's great. Okay. Now, about the reading today, what I want to do is start with the last two chapters of Knowledge of Time and Space, that is, the ones that were originally assigned, and then I added that additional chapter from the beginning of Knowledge of Time and Space. And I'll turn to that. And I really don't expect to get to the readings from Dynamics and TSK because we have a lot to cover as it is. So we've been talking about the bystander and the outsider. I probably said this already, but the first TSK book uses the terms bystander and outside stander. And Knowledge of Time and Space, which talks a lot about those same structures, instead of saying outside stander, uses the term outsider. That's just an editorial shift. It's the same thing. So don't feel like there's some subtle difference that's supposed to involve. So we're talking about the bystander and the outsider and their relationship to each other, and really in at a certain level, the relationship is that there isn't a relationship. That's what the reading starts off by pointing out. You know, you've got the bystander who does not occupy the world of outsiders. In the first TSK book, it mentions that you could think of, I think, cells in the body, something that's located right here, as being a bystander. But I would say that you can only do that if you want to think about the self as those cells, or let's say the brain. You know, maybe you'd say in some sense the brain could be thought of as the bystander, but really I tend to think of it a little bit more narrowly. The bystander is the one that then identifies itself as the I, ordinarily, and the one that is doing the doing, you know, and doing the knowing. It's the kind of unobservable central point from which everything happens. So you could think of it as the I in the sense of the I that looks, that sees. You know, the I can't see itself. And that's really, in a sense, the problem. The bystander is not an outsider. The bystander is not available to be known in the way that the bystander goes about knowing things. So you've got this split. You've got these two different realms of the bystander and the outsider. Another image you could think of is the image of looking in a mirror. When I was thinking about this, I thought about a fairly well-known novel from the 19th century in the English tradition. I think everybody knows about Alice in Wonderland, but Dodgson, the man who wrote that, wrote a sequel called Through the Looking Glass. And looking glass is just an old-fashioned term for mirror. In that, Alice climbs up on the mantelpiece of the fireplace and finds that she can go through the mirror into another world. And it's like kind of like that difference, you know, the bystander, you might say, holds up a mirror to reality, but that would be a little too complicated to try to work that image out. I'm just trying to make a simple point, really, that it's two different realms. And even though Alice was able to go into this other realm, the bystander cannot go into the realm of outsiders. So the question that gets asked is what about the space of the bystander? So the outsider has its ordinary objective space, although you can have, you know, outsiders can also be thoughts and so on. And that's something we looked at in the last session. You know, what we were looking at a kind of space which really doesn't rely on this distinction between bystanders and outsiders. Everything shows up in space. And essentially, we're moving toward the same notion with regard to time. Everything shows up in terms of a deeper time. That's what we really want to be looking at today. So the chapter asks about the space that the bystander occupies, and it's a space that we can never really and know anything about, because it's the same thing again. When you turn to look at it, and there's an image in Love of Knowledge that specifically talks about this, but when you turn to look at the space of the bystander, it's gone, because it becomes, at that point, the moment you turn to look at it, it becomes a space in which only outsiders can show up. So Michael has a question here. Is there an insider beside which the subject stands looking out? Is the insider immersed in time, space, and knowledge, and has no way of becoming articulate but by standing beside the inarticulate whole? Well, that might be a very interesting way to explore this. I'm a little skeptical because we really are wanting to move away from identities. The bystander assigns identities to outsiders and takes on an identity, a very particular, unique identity. And I don't know, if you multiply identities and create an insider, I'm not sure that would be so helpful. But you could think of it in terms of the witness. We've seen that the witness is also a kind of problematic identity, and we'll come back to that later in the program. So work it out, Michael. If you think there's something that's valuable to look at it this way, see where it leads you. Okay. Now, so we've been talking about the two separate spaces of the bystander and the outsider. Of course, we're focused on time, and so right now. And so our question is, what is the time of the bystander? And we've already talked about that, I think, in terms of the founding story. And then just generally, we've talked about stories. The bystander, at least when the bystander assigns the identity of self, whether there could be a bystander that wasn't a self, yeah, I think there could be, but it's kind of a theoretical question for us, because for us, the bystander takes on the identity of self. And the self is the one that occupies time in a way that allows for or requires past, present, and future. I'm going to go back to a comment here in the chat box because Sudhi comments on Michael's question and says, the presence is an insider. Well, we're going to talk about presence in a little while. And presence, well, as I said, I just don't think it's so helpful to try to identify another entity, you know, an insider or a presence. Now, presence as a kind of characteristic of experience, that's something that's different. We'll look at that. Okay, so the bystander is a occupies a time which unfolds, it's linear time, it's past, present, and future, and it unfolds in terms of stories, right? The narrative of the self. A place that the text talks about that is on 309, the end of the second full paragraph. Rinpoche is talking about the particular kind of awareness that a bystander has, the form of knowing that a bystander operates with. And with that knowing, he says, definitions are assigned and conclusions are reached on the basis of identities. That's what we were talking about a moment ago. And those identities are constructed through the interaction of momentary awareness, so that's the kind of point, instant, present, with past-centered interpretations and future-centered desires. So notice that this is it doesn't call it out in the same way, but this is really the same as what we talked about when we were reading from Love of Knowledge, descriptive knowledge, polar knowledge, and intentional knowledge. These are the ones that are being referred to. So that temporal structure of past, present, and future, and the identity of the self, that's where the bystander goes. That's how the bystander makes sense of things in terms of a self that knows and a world filled with objects, both physical and mental, that are known. It's an interesting question to ask. If the bystander occupies this narrative time, this story time, past, present, and future, what about outsiders? What kind of time do they occupy? And I'm not sure. What the best way is to think about that. But when I reflect on it, it seems to me you could say that really an outsider by definition doesn't occupy time at all. The word identity, after all, outsiders have identities, and we've talked about this. The word identity means same, right? It means sameness. And the whole idea of an outsider, when you identify it, is that it's the same forever and ever. And then it changes, but now it's become something else. And when we say, oh, it changed, which is almost a contradiction in terms if you're thinking about what it means to have an identity, but still we say it and we know what we mean. When we say it changed, what we're doing is we're imposing, you know, we in our bystander mode are imposing this past, present, future structure, which is the way we use to make sense of what goes on. And we're just attributing it to the world outside us. And we say that, you know, the past, present, future is objectively real. I'm not so sure that that's the case. You know, what happens is the bystander tells its story, and then everything that it comes across, all of the outsiders, are kind of props. You know, they help make sense of the story. And in order to do that, we treat them as operating in past, present, and future. And then, of course, the way we do that, I mean, the story that we wind up telling is that we're subject to that outside time, but my sense of what Rinpoche is saying here is that really the source of linear time, the past, present, future structure, is the bystander. And then the bystander's story includes this objective world with an objective time that is kind of bearing down on us, as he says at some point in this chapter. It seems very, seems like time becomes an outside force that's bearing down on us. But the origin is really more the inner story of the self. And then, you know, the story ends up being about an objective world, an objective time. And that story is in no way wrong. But we misunderstand what it's pointing towards. You know, its claim to be the objective reality ignores the more fundamental role of the bystander in projecting a past, present, future linear structure. I think I was going to give an example, but there's too much. So I'll just move on. The temporality that we ordinarily experience, the one that about past, present, and future, what I'm really saying is that that's the self's or the bystander's temporality. And in terms of that story, the founding story, remember Rinpoche says the founding story you could think of in terms of here I am, right? And you'd say, well, here is kind of the objective world, the outsider world. And that world, that you could say a corollary of here I am is, and there they are. And the way they are, involves also an unfolding in past and present and future. Okay, so that's the fundamental first level understanding, you could say, of how time operates. We have this past, present, future structure. It's related to the outsider. But, and here's where we start to move beyond that in this chapter, is there is an interaction. So we said before, we can't really figure out how the bystander and the outsider interact. It doesn't seem to make any good sense. But in fact, there is an interaction. And at the bottom of 308, there is a short discussion of that, which I think is very interesting. He says, the field of bystander-outsider interaction possesses a characteristic feel and an intrinsic temporal momentum that shapes the dynamic of observation. So, the bystander has this sense, this story of past, present, and future. But if you're going to make sense of the interaction between bystander and outsider, there are problems in trying to make sense of it. But if you're going to try to do that, then there has to be the time of the interaction. And that is, he refers to it here as an inner sense of time. So just reading on page 309, he says, as soon as an act of observation begins, so the observation is going to be this interaction. I mean, that's one form of interaction, right, between the bystander and the outsider. As soon as an act of observation begins, the bystander projects an inner sense of time. In a single moment, the energy of an inner intensive awareness contacts what will be identified as an observed object. Right? So there's the dynamic of connecting, of interacting. And then that dynamic gets interpreted in terms of past, present, and future, which is what that paragraph goes on to say. But that inner sense of time is potentially, you could say, is available without having to be tied in to past, present, and future. It's the time that of the observation or of the interaction, rather than the time which we use to shape or tell the story of the interaction. Now, what happens is that it's assigned, as he says here, to a single moment, a present moment that is this little point instant. That now we're in the linear structure of past, present, and future. It wouldn't necessarily have to be that way. We make that commitment to the story, but the inner sense of time is more fundamental than that. And so that really becomes the jumping off point, you could say, for an alternate approach. So the walkabout that I asked you to do for last week was really an attempt to engage that possibility and to do it in a specific way by bringing together past and present and future. And there are other exercises in the TSK that do that, bringing together the three times in a unified, integrated way. And by doing that, that offers a possible point of entry to this inner time that hasn't yet been spread out among the three times. So ordinarily, we just accept that everything has a past, present, and future structure. If you try to engage, if you make it a practice to engage past, present, and future together, that can change. That's one possible point of entry. It's not the only one. If anybody would like to comment on what they found in doing the practice, that walkabout practice, insofar as it relates to this, I'd be delighted to hear it or to see it written in the chat box. I'm going to move on, but if somebody comments, I'll come back to that because I think it's really fundamental. This possibility of a shift from past, present, future, linear time to the present, to an inner time that is more fundamental than that. There's finding ways to make that transition, looking for elements or aspects of our experience, or probably a better way to say that is revisioning our experience. Is fundamental to that. And maybe we could come back, Michael was referring to the insider immersed in time, space, and knowledge, the inarticulate insider, and Sudhi related that to presence. Well, maybe those were both ways of talking about the same point we're looking at here, which is this inner time, which is then immediately identified in terms of the present moment and then its particular past and future. So what happens is the term that Rinpoche uses here, and I think he uses it in a couple of other places too, is that the bystander becomes a biasstander, which is a nice little play on words in English. The bias is in terms of the structure of the bystander, which is this past, present, future linear structure that gives rise to the narrative story. Because we're committed to that, and because we're committed then to the identity that we assign to the bystander, the identity of the self, we're biased. We can't really engage accurately, immediately, and directly the possibilities that of this inner intensive awareness that Rinpoche refers to, or we could say the possibilities of the inner sense of time. So that's where we find ourselves. The possibility is there. We explored a practice that might help us do that. And now we want to see what else we might be able to work with. So that takes us to the second chapter of these two chapters in Knowledge of Time and Space, which has a somewhat different way of coming at, it seems to me, the same point. Before I go there, I see that Sudhi has commented, it seems for me that time disappears and more of an inclusive, vast awareness knowing takes over, which I call presence. Right, so even though, Sudhi, you capitalize time in your chat, your comment, what I would say is that if I understand you correctly, that you're looking at the possibility that our usual linear sense of time, of past, present, future unfolding, maybe disappears. And there's this inner time, which brings with it, and of course this is really fundamental throughout the reading we're doing now, it brings with it a different kind of knowledge, a vast awareness. And so then you call that presence. And I think that that's fine. I think that the presence, Rinpoche does sometimes talk that way about the possibility of presence. Notice, and maybe we'll have a chance to say a little more about this, notice that presence is very different from being in the present. I think there's a lot of interest nowadays is just kind of in the air, especially in Buddhist circles or sort of popular Buddhism, to talk about being in the present moment. But it's also, it's always around for people who are interested in these sorts of things. But if you take the present moment as this point instant, this single moment, the section we're just looking at talks about, if you take it as a single moment, there is a problem because that present moment will only make sense in terms of a presupposed past and future. That's where the bystander becomes a bystander. So Eliana asks, can the presence be the experience of inner time? Well, yeah, I think that's exactly what we were just talking about. Presence is a way that you might begin to look at this question of inner time. Now, the word experience is a little problematic. Somewhere in the readings for this week, Rinpoche says that he points out that experience is kind of a difficult word because it seems to automatically commit us to a self that is having an experience that unfolds over linear time. But yes, presence and inner time certainly are closely connected with each other, I would say. So in the next chapter, Rinpoche talks about this interaction between bystander and outsider in terms of being a field. And of course, we've looked at the word field a number of times with respect to space. So here in the first paragraph on 312, he talks about, or he asks the question, how do these fields, he's identified a number of fields, how do these fields function and how are they related to the field within which bystander and outsider jointly emerge? So the interaction, bystander and outsider, here it's recast a little bit as happening within a field. The interesting point, or the point that I want to emphasize here anyway, is that there's a field within which both bystander and outsider emerge. In that field, the bystander is the one that knows. And what that seems to imply, Rinpoche doesn't say that exactly here, but I feel pretty confident in this, what that seems to imply is that the bystander generates its own field. The self generates its own field. And it's the field of its own knowledge. You know, the bystander has its way of knowing and it has the range of what's possible for it to know. And all that happens within a field, you know, the field of the knowable, you could say, for the bystander. And so you've actually got these two different fields, which I think are also two different kinds of temporality. So what happens is the bystander knows in a particular way, and in that way of knowing, the linear sequence of time is taken for granted, is taken as given. And that's what what Rinpoche talks about at the top of 313. He says, let me go back to the bottom of page 312, because I think this is the move that I'm trying to identify. He says, as owners of the awareness specified by the field of conventional reality, we are already bystanders. So the bystander is the one that knows within the field of the conventional world. A field emerges, and then the bystander is the one that is knows, and this is at the top of 313, it's excluded from a deeper knowing, right? It's a bystander knowing. And then he says, an indication of this restriction is that awareness, so this is the bystander awareness, right, takes sequential time as given. Awareness affirms linearity through circularity. It proceeds step by step. It projects shape and form. And this is a really fundamental move. The sense capacities are based on that, he says. I'm just looking down through the discussion that continues on page 313. There's the sense faculties, and there are also the mental positionings, anger, desire, confusion, self-deception, love, joy, resentment, you know, the whole range of experience as we know it to be, as selves who have taken this bystander role, all of that emerges in connection with the sequential linear time. It's a limitation, but it's a very specific kind of limitation in which we start with a field which is in a sense more fundamental than the bystander, because that's the field within which the bystander-outsider interaction is going to arise. And the nature of that field is to establish the bystander as the one who has its own field. So there's these two different levels and two different kinds of time. So really what we're doing is setting up to understand more about inner time. Michael quotes a Russian proverb, to cross a field is not to live your life. I don't know what that means. Michael thoughtfully provides a commentary. Perhaps that's because we can cross a field without having a from and to, and so our relationship with fields needs to be more a diving in. Well, that's nice, actually. A field in the sense of something you can cross, like a field that you plant crops in, has a two-dimensional mode, which is very much like, it seems to me, linear time. Right? So the idea of diving into the field, I think that's completely appropriate in terms of how Rinpoche talks about this. The field is not, it encompasses everything, all possibilities. So you immerse yourself in the field. Later we'll talk a little about inhabiting the story, which is another way of describing that, but yes. Okay. So the bystander has its own field, but there's a deeper knowing. That's what we were just looking at, right? The bystander, because it's committed to its way of knowing and its field, is cut off from this deeper knowing, and it's also cut off from the deeper time. And that's what's being referred to when Rinpoche talks about taking sequential time as given. But there is what is the deeper time? The deeper time is the one that generates the field, right? Maybe I shouldn't make time the actor there, the one that generates the field, but in the emerging of bystander and outsider, there is a dynamic temporality, an aliveness, a vitality. And that is, I think, pointing towards this deeper time. It's actually referred to more or less that way on page 317. It's on 317. I don't have it marked, but I have the quote. It says, a vitality prior to distinctions and determinations. That's where we want to, that's our understanding, I think you could say, of what's involved with deeper time. It's a vitality that's prior to all the identifications and all the things and so on that emerge. We're going to start to get just a little more practical about this. and by practical, I mean, I find this a very illuminating discussion, but it does seem a little abstract. What he's saying about this deeper knowing, which goes with a deeper time, our focus is more on the time side, but they're really inseparable, is that it's more fundamental than all the specifics that we know. Right? And he says at the very bottom of 313 and then on to 314, not bound by sequential time, this knowing precedes the positionings that characterize conventional space. And this is what I meant when I said more practical, and it remains available and free even when caught in emotional constructs and perceptual frameworks. So the notion here is that in the bystanders, in the self's way of knowing, it's kind of hard to keep them always separate, bystander and self. In the self's way of knowing, there are emotional responses, there are particular ways of seeing and engaging the world and all of that. But there's always a deeper knowing. It's the emerging. It's the awareness within which all of that emerges, and it always remains available. So when I say it's more practical, what I mean is that the suggestion is being made here that we could remain in contact with or come into contact with this deeper knowing and a deeper temporality, no matter what's going on in the kind of surface level, you could say, of our experience. And the way to do that, and he definitely gets into this now, is on 315, where he actually says, okay, let's go beyond hypotheticals here. What do we do? Well, we turn away from the content. The field of the bystander, the outsiders, are the content of the field of the bystander. And we turn away from that. It's not that we cut it off or deny its existence, but we don't put our focus there. He says, talking about the temporal order as a specific presentation and exhibition, which is not centered on the self. And he says, we can turn, this is about eight lines from the bottom of 315, we can turn from the content of what is known, that's all those outsiders, right? Turn from the content of what is known to look at the interaction between what time presents, space exhibits, and knowledge knows. So this is this emerging, this arising, and the exercise for the week, LOK 47, is very much about that. So if you worked with that, that would give you some insight into this, or this discussion might give you some insight into the exercise. So what happens in this way of knowing is that the knower and the known become the same. I'm quoting a little bit. He says, knowing and being at this higher level, he says. Knowing and being, well, he says, the accommodation of space and the dynamic of time unfold in knowledge to present an existence that is our own. Right? Knowing and knower are the same. So that's the possibility that an inner time makes available. So the idea here is that we want to see through our ordinary structures, break out, it's not quite the right word, but of the field of the in which the bystander reaches out to know outsiders, and arrive at this deeper time, which I think it's fair to say, and people have pointed this out several times, has to do with presence. Okay, so now let's go back and look at the earlier chapter. it's kind of interesting to me, you know, when I was thinking about how to present this, I asked, you know, I said, well, I think I want to do these later chapters and then go to the early chapter of Knowledge of Time and Space and say, well, wait a minute, why is that? You know, doesn't Knowledge of Time and Space have its own internal structure where you move from the beginning to the end? And maybe this is cheating, but my response to that is to say, only if you look at things in a linear unfolding kind of way. If you say that a deeper knowing, a deeper timing, let's say, and a more accommodating space, if those are always available, then you can find the depth of the TSK vision everywhere, you know, and there isn't so much a logical progression. So if you go back and look at this first chapter, that is sequentially the first, in light of what we've been talking about, I think you find a tremendous depth in it. It's a great, great chapter. We don't have much time, but let's take a few minutes to look at it. It's actually remarkable how closely linked it is to the themes we've been talking about. He talks about how linear time and the known world in general arises through a twofold activity of establishing and knowing. And so the same question comes up. What's the dynamic of that establishing and knowing? You can find the linear dynamic, linear temporality in what's established and what's known, and how everything then interacts with everything else. But what about the dynamic through which something is established and known? That, again, is this inner time. And he talks about that on page, at the top of page 36. He just mentions it in passing. He says, at the bottom of 35, actually, he says there's a gradual development toward an interpretive order. It's as though the inner dynamic, once activated, projects its temporality into the external time frame. So first there's an inner dynamic, and somehow it's activated. And let's see if we can understand a little better what that means. We've already talked about the activity of establishing and knowing. So that's, you could say, the activating. Now, what's activated, once something is established and known, is the linear structure, a particular temporal order. And here Rinpoche introduces the idea, I think it comes up for the first time here in this book, but he uses it elsewhere, of the logos. The logos is the temporal order that gets established. What's activated, what's established and known in this inner timing is the logos, the temporal order. I'm emphasizing it a little right now because when we start up again in July, the theme that we'll be exploring for the knowledge, the whole knowledge section, the way we'll be approaching it, is through the logos. That's the central theme. So here it's introduced and it's very... very helpful, I think, to take a look at it here, and it's also a great preparation for where we're going. The point that he makes, still on page 36, he says, when you're looking in terms of the order that's established by this inner dynamic of time, what you find is the logos, and the logos is more fundamental than whatever shows up in the logos, you know, you could say in the field. I mean, logos is very related to field. It's got a different thrust. It's more related to knowledge. But whatever shows up is less fundamental. And so he says here in the second paragraph on 36, subject and object, roughly speaking, we could say bystander and outsider because we've been talking that way, subject and object are no longer the key actors. Instead, there are patternings presented by the logos and thus bound to one another. So it's a very interesting kind of a threefold structure here. There's our ordinary understanding in which there's the, maybe there's even fourfold. So the bystander projects a certain understanding out into the world, which includes linear time, and that understanding gives us subject and object and world and all of that. So then if we look at a little bit more fundamental level, more basic, we see that that's the work of the bystander making sense of outsiders, right? But now if we step back beyond that, or step earlier, not quite the right word, we discover the logos, the order that patterns all of that. And then if we say, well, what about the logos? Where does that come from? Well, that comes out of this inner dynamic of time, which activates and knows. So those are all dimensions in which we could be exploring, and every level of exploration would have its own flavor. And for those of you coming on the retreat, I think we'll be doing some of that, but we'll also look at it next term because we'll be looking, as I said, at the logos. So as he says very specifically on this page, he says, conventional time is a structure of the logos. And maybe we could even accept that without too much trouble, but then he also says, as I've already said, subject and object are patternings in the logos. So there's a dynamic that's activated, but in the activation, something is lost, or maybe instead of saying something is lost, we could say something is specified, is put into fixed structures. So Michael comments on that. He says, gratitude for the shell that gives us an opportunity to hatch. That's a nice image. You could think of the logos that way. We've been thrust into being, but it's a being that's been carved out for us in advance. That's the shell of the egg, by the logos. The knowing that flows, I'm quoting Michael, the knowing that flows in fixed structures transports the capacity to contact an inner time and a deeper knowing. ? Is that right? He asks. Well, I suppose you could say it could go in either direction. If we arrive at this sort of middle point of the logos, ordinarily, the logos just unfolds kind of automatically into the structure of bystander and outsider and self and world and time that bears down on us from outside and all of those things. But if you understand the role, and as you say, I think it's very nice, Michael, if you view the logos as a structure which is activated, and in that activation allows for engaging a deeper knowing and a deeper timing through the structures that manifest in the logos, if all of that stays alive and open, then yes, the logos is a way into this inner time and deeper knowing. Okay, good. But let's see if there's anything else I think is absolutely essential to say, because we're at the end of our time. Well, maybe it's just kind of by summary. Instead of engaging what's been established, which is the usual structure, we would like to go to the activity of establishing and knowing. And that was already implicit in the other chapter where we talked about turning away from the content, right? What shows up in the logos to how it shows up. That's the dynamic, that's inner time. And it becomes an ongoing activity that is always available, right? So we want to go, he says on page 37, we want to go to the point at which momentum takes form. And that doesn't mean, of course, a point in the past where the momentum that creates our ordinary world begins to operate. There's this always emerging momentum of the logos, and it's important, I think, to understand. Logos is probably most related to knowledge, if you think in terms of time, space, and knowledge. But if you think about it in terms of time, which is completely appropriate, it's alive, it's dynamic, it's a structure, but it's a structuring. It's an ongoing activity. And we want to be able to engage that activity. And there's a very nice passage. There's a very nice passage at the in right here where Rinpoche talks about the presentations that arise as inspired presentations of the Logos. And that's on page 38. So what shows up is this kind of inspired dimension of our experience. And when we can let ourselves be inspired, is probably the right way to say that, then inner time flows through us. And we don't have to rely on the usual structures that we know so well, the bystander, the outside stander or outsider, and linear time. Okay, I think I'm going to stop there. We are taking, as I said, a fairly long break. So we'll be back again. We'll meet together again on July 13th, and I will post some of the readings and so on well before then. Okay, thank you very much, everybody.